And welcome to our roundtable panel for this Wednesday, the 14th of August, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. A reminder, you can always weigh in and certainly share your thoughts on the issues that we talk about by going to roundtable at wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or tweet at us or to us or with us at WAMC Roundtable. Jimmy Vielkind from the Times Union and their Capital Reporter will be with us shortly, soon, I'm guessing. And WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us right now and made it for class in time. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, Joe, I'm fine. I've been thinking a lot. Just thinking all the time about things.
Anything you want to share of what's on your list here, what you've been thinking about?
Well, I've been thinking about the blackouts.
Yeah.
We all know we've been flooded with how they started, that the tree hit the twig hit the line. You know, there was chaos afterwards. But when Americans are faced with a crisis, it's always interesting to see how they react. I've been through several blackouts now. I remember one, I think it was 65, something like that. And when I was working on my doctorate down at NYU, people talking to each other in the streets, you know, getting close together in a number of different ways. It's an interesting time. Billions of dollars get lost in those things. Freezers spoil, you know, food spoils. But New Yorkers who classically don't talk to each other, do and make contact and help each other. It's really quite something. And if you live in a, or work in a building and you get caught 100 floors up, or something like that. It's really, really people looking on their neighbors. People care. It's an interesting phenomenon.
50 million people were impacted by the blackout that we are commemorating. What's the word?
Thinking about it.
Right. The 10th anniversary of the blackout, which I guess started in Cleveland and then affected 8 states, including a large chunk of Canada. But in addition to that, when you think about that 10 years, that would bring it into 2003. And for New Yorkers, when that first happened, the immediate there was I think a lot of fear immediately because of the
terror.
Of terror, because it was just a year and a half, 2 years after 9/11. So almost 2 years. So it was I think a scary time for a lot of people, and not knowing what was going on. And there's a little bit of excitement, but I think there's also fear mixed with that as well. And I think you referenced 1965, and we see these blackouts, but I think our moods about them change as we become more and more dependent on certain technologies, like an elevator to get us down from the 39th floor, but also to with what's going on in the world, of what is causing that blackout, and may just be more than just a storm.
You know, there's a guy who calls up in every Vox Pop and says, no matter what the subject, it's a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Now, you could say, okay, we've tracked it down. We know it was the tree limb touching the wire. The wire was heavy because it was of time, a lot of usage and rest, and we know that started. That guy would say to me, that's a conspiracy. Come on, Alan. He'd laugh at me and say, I know that was a conspiracy. So there's a whole segment of our population who believe that, the answer is that somebody did it for some reason, either because they were a right-winger or a left-winger or because they were a terrorist or because whatever.
Right, but they're also that not knowing. And you don't know. If you can't communicate and you can't find out and you can't turn on your radio and you can't turn on your television and you can't get out of your building and you don't know, that can be a scary time, especially in the climate that we live in, where you know darn well the first thing that the news media, if you did get the reports, is what is causing this. And there's going to be that period. Sure, at some point, they're going to attribute it to the tree limb. But between the time that it happens and the time that they make the attribution, you don't know what. And I think a lot of us are tuned to have our minds go wild.
Did you remember the excellent NPR story yesterday about the camp, the summer camp, where they're teaching kids how to hack?
Yeah.
Now, that's scary. Because, you know, there may be some 12-year-old out there who's going to hack into the electrical grid and figure out, you know, how to do this thing. And just for kicks, do it. So that's also something that it comes along with the new technology and our dependence on it.
The I don't really understand. These are elementary students who are brought in, and they're taught how to
hacking
take apart
camp.
Things.
Hacking camp.
And they can hack smart TVs, and they learn to pick locks at this convention in Las Vegas, and they learn to do a whole bunch of things, which I guess allows them to know more about you know what makes them up, you know, what's their makeup, but also how to break them down.
What was the name of that great film in which the guy plays a Czech kiting expert, and he finally gets caught? You know, the FBI chases them all around. Very popular film, and in the end, when they run the scroll at the end, they say he's been working for the FBI for all these years, because who better? You know, and apparently some of the major corporations were delighted that the kids were doing this and trying to break into
they
the
learn
places.
How the kids get in, so then they can build up the safety nets and the firewalls to make sure that doesn't happen.
Do you find any of this scary? I do.
I find it scary that it is possible, and I also find it scary that and I don't know if you notice this, but I find it scary that, you know, it's the kids that can sort of think of this. That have that mindset to be able to go. I think a lot of us operate under an assumption that is that the kids know this stuff better than anybody else.
Some of them are clearly born with it. I mean, I don't understand how it happens. I mean, my boy Jonas, we bought the first generations of computers, like K-Pros. Remember K-Pros and things like that? And I'd take it out and I, you know, he didn't know anything except that he'd say, here's how to do it. Now, I think it gets born in the atmosphere. I don't know. He was 10 years old or 11 years old.
Remember the TRS-80?
No, I don't think we had that.
The Tandy 1000?
No, I remember them, but I don't think we had that one.
Early computers.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute and continue our conversation on other topics, and we welcome you to join us as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Jimmy Vilkind will be here shortly, I believe.
Maybe.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Cultural Pittsfield and Islam Contemporary, exploring contemporary Islamic culture and life through a group art show featuring 25 artists from around the world and special events through August 31st. Discover pittsfield.com/Islam Contemporary. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine in, take out, delivery. 518-432-0358. A New Leaf Used Books, Pine Plains, New York. An independent bookstore carrying over 10,000 volumes of fiction, poetry, history, gardening, cookbooks, and more. A New Leaf Used Books on Facebook.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. One of the things, this is, I think this is an interesting story because, of course, Edward Snowden has been granted asylum in Russia, and now all of the major networks, not only in this country but throughout the world, are trying to land the big interview,
I think he had a promise that he wouldn't do that.
So Glenn Greenwald, one of two reporters to disclose the existence of the National Security Agency surveillance programs, has held preliminary talks with American TV networks to conduct an interview with his chief source, which is, of course, the fugitive leaker, Edward Snowden. Greenwald said yesterday that he decided not to do the interview despite discussing a licensing fee of up to $50,000 for landing an interview with Snowden. An interview with Snowden would be a major coup for any news outlet, but few journalists have access to the 30-year-old former governor contractor who fled the United States and has been granted asylum in Russia. Greenwald, who works for the Guardian newspaper, is one of the few journalists who conceivably could land such an interview. Snowden contacted him anonymously earlier this year, and they built this relationship, which ultimately led to the disclosure of details of the NSA's massive and secret database of this program called PRISM. He also he was not the only journalist he contacted. He also contacted Barton Gellman, who reported on the program for The Washington Post. And so both Greenwald said via email that he spoke with NBC and in a preliminary sense with ABC about a Snowden interview. And I think so they're wondering if it's whether it's in their best interest. Greenwald says, one, I don't want to distract away from NSA spying and the substance of the disclosures by refocusing attention to Snowden. Two, Snowden agreed with my suggestion that doing an interview at this time was not productive for the same reason. He wants media attention on the NSA, not on himself. And three, I saw no real value in the interview. It would be used just as crass entertainment, and so didn't want to be involved right now. Greenwald said that only fees ever discussed were $25,000 if he was hired as a correspondent to do the interview, or a $50,000 licensing fee.
Yeah, I think there was a fourth reason. Truly, I think that he was told not to do it by the Russian government, who, you know, putting a stick in the U.S. eye, and said he's going to be quiet, basically. You know, it's jail. You know, you want to come back to the United States and be in jail, or you want to do what the KGB colonel tells you to. And that is another part of this story that I think is so fascinating. Look, this guy Putin was a KGB colonel. He was a spy. I don't think this is a guy who's made up of tremendous morality, and will do whatever is in his, what he perceives is in his best interest. You know, to leak this stuff was probably good for him, and probably the American people, the Russians liked it. Also, we now see him, frankly, gay bashing. I mean, you know, we're talking about Putin and saying, well, you know, we're going to have the Olympics here, but we don't like gay people, and we have laws, and we have this and that. It's I've always wondered whether fascism and communism were kissing cousins. In other words, whether autocracy, whether a single person running everything. It didn't really matter what the announced ism was. In the end, it's a dictatorship. And the Russians apparently have such a long history of that. They find it very hard to get away from, even though they were capable of speaking out and raising a little hell. But now it does seem they're back into the usual, same old, same old.
Edward Snowden, according to Greenwald, said, Edward Snowden doesn't trust many people, and he certainly doesn't trust journalists. Which, you know,
do you think he trusts Putin?
That's a slam. Yeah. The question is also, I guess, would be what we would get out of an interview, and I don't know if that would be much. And I think they're right. It would certainly take the focus off the NSA and put it more on Snowden.
But
easily, there's mystery around Snowden, so I think it's still there.
But. Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, you know, I don't know if you stopped the first 100 Americans you met on State Street in Albany and asked them what this was all about. I don't think they'd know a lot. Be honest with you. I don't think there is enough focus on what the NSA was doing. And I, you know, I say that fully aware that the walls have ears. But you know, I think that this is a very difficult time. The NSA did a lot of stuff, but most people don't know what was in those documents, and they hardly could tell you what the NSA was if you asked them. So to say,
but I mean, that's the point, meaning that they would have more interest in a figure, more in the story and the mystery of Snowden versus what was actually happening.
Yeah, but
the
Snowden
NSA
could point the finger at specific things that were discovered from the NSA stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I think, you know, I would go against the prevailing opinion that there shouldn't be an interview. I think there should. And I think, you know, you got the father going over there now and saying, I thought I saw a ghost. The father going over there and saying, I don't want my son to stay there. I want him to come back under the right circumstances and stand trial. Over here, I'm wondering, I'm scratching my head and I'm saying, I wonder if the kid and the father are on the same page here.
Yeah. And it's also one of those stories that obviously will be going on for a long time as this works its way through, diplomacy and through courts and so forth. But there's a lot of interesting information, and you do assume at some point he will talk to the press. It seems a fair bet. Well, yeah, we'll get them all set up. We have a break in just a minute, and then we'll get them all set up. Jimmy's here.
Hello.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Excellent.
Sky is clearing. There is blue to the west and clouds to the south.
It's very nice to have you here. You're just in time to listen to some NPR news.
Excellent.
And then we'll talk to you about all kinds of good stuff, including about the New York City mayoral poll. We'll talk about good government groups working on J-COPE, and we'll talk about some other stuff as well.
I look forward to it.
Excellent. We'll be back after this short break. You're listening to the Roundtable panel. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel. Joining us this morning, WAMC's Alan Chartok and Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind is here as well. Jimmy, good morning. Welcome to the discussion. Good to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Let us discuss the latest poll from New York City and a poll regarding the mayoral race in the Big Apple. This we look at about a month away. September 10th, the primary is quickly coming, a month to go. And we see in this the most liberal of the leading candidates, Bill de Blasio, is ahead, according to a new poll. Quinnipiac says that so far, Mr. de Blasio has 30% of voters. Christine Quinn would have 24%. William Thompson, a former controller, has 22%. And Anthony Weiner, who was once the front runner of this race, is now down to under 10% in the race.
And according to the Siena poll released earlier this week, 80% of voters statewide, not citywide, and of course he's running for a city office, 80% had a negative approval rating, a negative thought about Anthony Weiner.
They said it was the highest negative approval
ever in the history of
any
of
politics ever.
The second runner-up for that was Eliot Spitzer, who I think the week or the week and a half after he resigned hit 79%.
Yeah.
So good for you, Anthony. Congratulations. So another poll, another leader, the horse race continues. And, you know, de Blasio has been betting that as the most progressive candidate, he would have this sort of appeal. You know, he's a Brooklyn guy and he tries to emphasize that. And he's hoping that this sort of outer borough, these outer borough roots combined with a liberal cast that would help endear him to some of the leftier precincts, mostly in Manhattan in the Democratic primary, would be a winning combination. And, you know, he's been fighting for labor support with some of the other candidates. I think some of the big unions have bet on Bill Thompson as the candidate for this race. Thompson, of course, the only black candidate in the Democratic field. I don't know what this means. It means that it's his turn. And I can't help but think of the Republican presidential primary. Remember where every poll had a different leader?
Right.
Remember Newt Gingrich was leading the pack and Herman Cain was leading the pack, and just sort of you rise up and then everyone attacks you and you fall down.
And Mickey Carroll, who released the poll yesterday, said that you know, the lineup's going to keep changing, and you got to follow the bouncing ball. And the television commercials haven't really started in full force yet, and that'll have a lot to do with it. But Alan, I'm curious if you have three candidates, if you take Wiener out of it for a moment, and you say, okay, you have these three candidates, and they're all getting between 25% and 30% of the polling, and you have a 5% margin of error. You know, it's anybody's race.
Could depend on who you called up that day.
Yeah,
I mean, there is some of that. I think it's interesting. I think de Blasio is going to stay a contender. And, of course, we do know that Quinn will be a contender. And remember that in New York City, Jimmy, correct me if I'm wrong on this, if you don't get 50% of the vote, 40% of the vote in the primary, then you have a runoff. And so now the betting is going to be who's going to be in the runoff.
Right. And that's been the strategy for a lot of these candidates. They feel if they can get in the runoff, then they have to defeat the other person, and then they have to defeat the Republican candidate. So it's really a three-step election. And so really these candidates are trying to be in that top two. And some of the smart consensus had been that it would be Quinn in the runoff, or it would be Thompson in the runoff. And then you're kind of jockeying for that second spot. I think that the poll prior to this Quinnipiac poll had Quinn in the lead. She is, to continue my Republican analogy, sort of the Mitt Romney of the race. You know, everyone kind of says, yeah, you know, Chris Quinn is the strongest candidate. She is probably the most reasonable, you know, consensus Democratic candidate, the inevitable candidate, the inevitable frontrunner, the inevitable, you know, the heir apparent here. And so then the question becomes, well, okay, who is it against? Is it against Bill Thompson? Or is it against Bill de Blasio? If it's against Thompson, there's a big racial factor, right? A person of color against a Caucasian woman. Of course, a woman, the first woman who I believe could be capturing the major party nomination for mayor of New York City.
Mm-hmm. And gay.
And gay, of course. Though Ruth Messinger, remind me, did Ruth Messinger capture the Democratic Party nomination? I don't remember.
You're asking me to remind you.
But certainly there would be gender dynamics, racial dynamics that would play into it. And there are lots of people that really resent Speaker Quinn for what they see as enabling Mike Bloomberg, and people who really don't view the mayoral tenure of Mike Bloomberg positively blame Speaker Quinn as an enabler, especially when it came to overturning the term limits law.
For one election.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So that's it's going to be interesting. We'll see how it shakes out. Lots of shoes are yet to drop, as you pointed out. No ads are really on the air yet. The New York Times is expected to endorse in the race, and their endorsement carries some weight in the Democratic primary field, again, particularly in those leftier precincts in Manhattan. So lots left to go. And the way this campaign cycle, the way any campaign cycle goes, it's arguably, even though we're maybe 4 weeks from election day, from primary day, excuse me, it's still early. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. And what about the do any of these polls, whether it be Santa or Quinnipiac, have any momentum with them in the sense of if you say, okay, look, Bill de Blasio seems to be the leading candidate, does that bring with it a momentum so that they can show up at a rally and show up at an event and say, look, we're stronger than the other person?
Yeah, to an extent. But the way the way that typically works is it's sort of this this self-fulfilling cycle, right, in that a poll shows viability. And viability could be cast as inevitability, and inevitability comes with money and support because you want to be with the guy or the gal who's the inevitable winner, and therefore you don't want to cross them, and then that feeds on itself, right? Then if you get the support and the money and the more ads, then you repulse any ride. It's this self-fulfilling cycle.
I think everything you've said is true, except that one has intuition about these things. My intuition is the fact that he has risen to the top now and that he mirrors the values of many New Yorkers, center-left folks. I think, and you can write this down, that he's going to stay there, that he's going to stay as the sort of liberal contender in this thing.
We talk about this all the time, especially in going back to your analogy of the presidential contest. But, you know, when somebody would drop out, you would say, well, where is their support going to go? So while Anthony Weiner has not dropped out, certainly he has.
He's dropped.
His numbers have dropped substantially. Yeah. So the question is, where does that support go? And if he were to drop out, where does that support go?
Well, I don't think he's going to drop out. I think he's made a calculated decision, which is, if I drop out now, I'm a joke for the rest of my life. And if I stay in, I maintain some credibility.
I may only be a joke for 30 or 40 years.
Some credibility.
Yeah, I think that that's worth exploring. And I think it's not perhaps an accident that Mr. Wiener's fall has coincided with Mr. de Blasio's rise. There was a lot of talk when Wiener entered the race that the candidate most hurt in terms of the overlap in the base was Bill de Blasio. And so, you know, de Blasio was one of the most strident critics of Anthony Wiener, one of the most outspoken against him in those earlier weeks of his candidacy. So, yeah, I think that there is some correlation there. But, you know, again, it's 4 weeks till election day, till primary day, and we'll see how things shake out. I don't know. I'm not ready to pronounce de Blasio as the liberal favorite. I'm not ready to say that things have coalesced around him just because so much has happened. And again, because when someone rises up in the field, when someone becomes a front runner, inevitably you get filled with arrows and stones. And that has not really happened to Bill de Blasio. But maybe in the coming days, we'll see it start to happen.
There's a sort of interstitial whispering campaign that he's the liberal. I don't think a lot of people knew who he was, to be honest with you. But I think they do now. I think it's beginning to mount up. So I guess I would disagree with your assessment.
Saying that his name ID is cemented.
I think he's growing now. And he is, for the West Siders that I know and for the others, he's now the guy. So I think, I don't know that he's going to win.
Why wasn't he the guy before?
Because I don't think everybody, even though he had a major office, nobody knew him. I don't think people really understood who he was. Now I think there's a sort of coalescence among types who say, okay, our guy is, and this is our guy, the liberal, you know, guy who carries our mantle. And if that's the case, then you have to watch what happens with people like the teachers unions and others, and how much they're going to say, okay, as you said before, Jimmy, what the inevitability is.
Right. But of course, you remember that the teachers union is backing Bill Thompson.
Yeah, so far.
Well, so far, but yeah. I think it's going to be tough for them to undo that endorsement at this point in the process.
Yeah, well, there's how much you want to spend, how much you want to put on the barrel ad.
Yeah,
how many ads do you want to buy, and the rest of it. I've watched a lot of mayoral elections in New York City as a lifelong resident for years and years. I watch what happens to these guys. I watched Ed Koch start out as a flaming liberal. You remember that? He was the Village Independent Democrats, and there was nobody more liberal than him. In our last interviews with him on this station, I have to tell you, you couldn't have gone much. There was no wiggle room on the right. So people change.
Hmm. I want to go before our break. Let's talk about your story this morning regarding the real estate donors for Governor Cuomo among the Moreland subpoena targets. And meanwhile, the governor says he supports all this.
Right.
Good story.
Right. Well, and a lot of this was reported last week by the New York Daily News, who noticed these donations from Extel Development, a Manhattan-based developer that has, as one of its marquee project, a building called 157, which is this, I think, 55-story condo tower on 57th Street. It'll be so high that you'll be able to see right into Central Park in Midtown on Manhattan. And so these developers often have a lot of what are called LLCs, limited liability corporations. Mm. And what you do in your developer is you make a building and you create an LLC, which is this legal entity, and the LLC owns the building. And that way, if something happens, if the building goes bust or if, you know, it gets struck by lightning or whatever, the only thing that it takes down is this LLC, right? It limits your liability, you know. And so under New York campaign law and under rulings of the New York State Board of Elections, these LLCs are treated as individuals, and therefore they are subject to the campaign finance limits of an individual, which means that if you're a wealthy developer or a business person, you have access to lots of these LLCs, and as such, your donating power is greatly amplified. And so this is known, and apparently the Moreland Commission is looking into it and looking into why a housing bill considered and signed in January of this year somehow included special tax breaks for five projects including 157, this Extel project. And so they've issued subpoenas, they've started asking. And it looks, you know, it smells funny because all these developers give to all these guys, including Governor Andrew Cuomo, who received checks from them just days before he signed the legislation. So it looks bad. It smells funny. And there are people who are saying that if it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So this is the kind of thing, this is exactly what this Moreland Commission convened in July by Governor Cuomo and working in concert with Attorney General Eric Schneiderman was tasked with and has said it is going to look at. Things that are not necessarily illegal on their face and which may not be illegal, but which you look at and you think, that's legal? You can do that? You can give, you know, you can give $100,000 to someone, or, you know, 2 weeks before he signs a bill that gives you several million in tax breaks? That's okay? Well, that's the system?
Well, their job is to follow the money. That's what they that's what they said.
Right.
And they said from the beginning, and I said, you got a governor who's got $29 million in the bank, and some of that came from somewhere.
Some of it did come from somewhere. And the thing is, you know, you could throw a stone at Governor Cuomo here. But I spoke with Susan Lerner, who is the executive director of a good government group called Common Cause. And she said, you know, we're not going to pick one person because everybody does this. Everybody. And sure enough, if you pull up the contributions from Extel or from its president, Gary Barnett, you'll see checks to everyone. You'll see checks to the Democrats who dominate the assembly. You'll see checks to Senate Republicans. Common Cause did an analysis which found that since 2005, 75% of the money that the Real Estate Board of New York and entities affiliated with it have donated to candidates for the state Senate has come to districts outside of New York City. Now, this is a group that represents large real estate owners in New York City. And 75% of its giving has been to candidates outside of New York City. Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing?
But, you know, great reporters like yourself, Jim, are always looking for where the line is and how you can look over that line. So for example, as you say, none of this is illegal. But if somebody has been reported to say, or if the NSA or the FBI or anybody else has a line in which somebody says, if you do this,
right,
then I'll do that,
right, the minute
that's go to jail.
Right. The minute you say quid and quo, the minute you exchange an action for a contribution, you are subject to bribery. You are subject to prosecution by either a state or a federal prosecutor. But everyone knows that. And so you don't say things. You just smile and wink
Everyone knows it, except you're quite right. But then you get right. Joe Bruno and you get other people like that. And Malcolm Smith, is Malcolm Smith one of the guys who have this kind of thing? And then you have people who, for some reason, keep on doing it.
Right. Right. And that's what's always interesting when you see these prosecutions and these alleged misdeeds. You kind of say, well, you know, if you had just taken the money in your campaign account, it would have been perfectly legal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, yes. Why did you take the cash bribes?
So the answer, of course, is an ethics panel.
Well, right. And since 2011, there has been this new ethics panel, which we've talked about on this program. And I'm sure listeners are at least somewhat familiar with the Joint Commission on Public Ethics,
yep,
which was created in 2011, which was hailed by Governor Cuomo and the other elected class members in this state as going to be able to clean up Albany. And now, 2 years later, two years and change later, they're talking about how it has flaws and it has problems. And they're talking about how can they change it. So my colleague Rick Carlin reported this morning about how some groups are actually quietly surveying lawyers, good government types, about, well, how can we fix Jacob? What should be the changes? How can we coalesce around
certain things?
Well, I think it's a little bit early to say, but there are questions about how, for example, Jacob can exempt certain groups from donor disclosure requirements. These are requirements that were included in that 2011 law that say that the donors to New Yorkers for New York, for example, and I made that group up, would have to be disclosed, the major donors, so that you would know when New Yorkers for New York airs ads attacking Senator Shartok, viciously attacking him, you would know who the source of that money is.
But of course, the fact is, to me, the way you'd fix it is, and this is where it gets into questions of democracy, is who appoints the members of JACOB?
Right.
Do the legislature appoint the members, and do those people, and then we had this mysterious resignation of Pat Bulgaro that you guys wrote about.
Yes, Pat Bulgaro, a longtime state government hand who was the designee of Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver.
Right, so why did he quit?
Well, it's unclear. Mr. Bulgaro hasn't been talking, and no one at Jacob has said anything other than that they wish him well and thank him for his service.
Maybe he saw something or heard something that he found that he didn't want. Maybe.
Maybe.
That he didn't want to go along with.
Maybe. I'm not prepared to speculate.
I'm prepared to speculate, as always.
But it also comes down to this idea of, you know, Jacob is the worst possible watchdog we could ever imagine, except, of course, for all the others that we've talked about.
Well, the big thing that Andrew Cuomo had going for him in Jacob is that for the first time you had one ethics commission that was going to look at everybody.
Right.
In the old days, the legislature had a do-nothing sort of ethics commission of its own.
Yep.
Papa Cuomo appointed, you know, an executive commission that would really raise hell with its employees, and did, by the way. So this was a big contribution from Andrew, and he did what was best for him,
right,
which was to get this whole overview from one commission. That was a big contribution, but I said at the time it was going to be a weak group, and it is.
But at the same token, this same 2011 law had, in addition to creating JCOPE and this commission, it had some pretty good disclosure requirements that have actually changed the way business is done in Albany, and that has shown more light into the inner workings and the motivations of our legislators than we have had in generations.
Yeah, but the question, Jimmy, is how much? So in other words, if you're saying to people, how much did you give, how much do you earn, why don't we just go all the way and say, okay, instead of between this number and that number. Now, it's true that they collapsed some of those numbers, but the fact of the matter is you still don't have to say it was $3 million, 67 cents, and no change.
But what's the marginal utility of knowing that it's $3 million and 67 cents or between $3 million and $3.25 million?
I'll tell you, my friend, I'll tell you what it is right here in River City. The reason that it's important is that when you say it's somewhere between, people's eyes glaze over. They have no idea what you're talking about. Some will and some won't. And yet, when you say it's $3,600,000, they say, whoa, that's an interesting figure. That's my difference with you on this.
So, but the challenge here, though, is that, let's say this informal survey that, again, my colleague Rick Carlin reported on this morning. Let's say it comes up with some good ideas.
And just talk a little bit about the survey of how they're doing it, because it's like on a scale from 1 to 5, and you go through all the stuff, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And what does that mean?
And it can be anonymous.
Right, and it can be anonymous. But even if this survey turns up good ideas, they have to be acted on by the legislature. So since the legislature is responsible for setting the rules about policing everybody, you know, how hard are they going to do?
Sure.
Why would you elect a wolf to watch the hens?
If you're the hen. That's the problem with Jacob to begin with.
Right.
Indeed. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will finish up and talk about other stuff. We welcome your input as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Tannery Pond Concerts in New Lebanon, New York, presenting Russian pianist Vasily Primakov and Natalia Lavrova this Saturday at 8 p.m., 888-820-1696. Spirit House, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world. Wine tastings, Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com. And Sunwood Builders, Amherst, Massachusetts, over 20 years of green and custom home building, offering home remodeling services and energy retrofits, working to save energy while maintaining design features, sunwood-builders.com.
Welcome back to the roundtable panel. Thank you very much for being with us. And as always, we welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. So is it a quiet weekend like Wobegon in the Capitol?
Yeah, things have quieted down a little bit. The governor has been going on these road trips to showcase the glories of upstate America.
And his upstate numbers are rising.
Right, you know. Funny about that, how
it
that
works.
Yeah. So yesterday he was in the
works
Finger
so
Lakes.
Well, the president's doing it.
Yeah,
week.
Right.
Yeah, well, the real question is, will it overcome, you know, the apprehension people had about the SAFE Act, the guns?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's when his numbers dropped.
Right. I think it's early to say. But the governor is, in doing so, you know, we could maybe crassly or cynically point out that his numbers do go up.
Right.
But at the same time, he is drawing attention to the great glories of upstate America. Yesterday, it was wine in the Finger Lakes, a major wine-producing region, not just on the level of the state, but on the level of the nation. So you have a picture of Andrew Cuomo drinking a glass of Finger Lakes wine, and that's valuable to the vintners in the Finger Lakes. And shouldn't we all be supporting our fellow New York businesses, taxpayers, and in this case, winemakers. The other day, he was at Watkins Glen Speedway ahead of the marquee race there to talk about the dangers of texting and driving. And yeah, texting and driving is bad. And
especially if you're during the NASCAR
sprint
race.
Right.
Yeah, that's really bad.
I don't think they do that. I don't know, but I don't think that they're texting while they're driving.
And that's a road course.
And, you know, last week he was up in St. Lawrence County to talk about a Bassmaster fishing tournament, and he was fishing. And, you know, a few weeks ago I went whitewater rafting with him near Indian Lake. So this is a theme, and I think we might see a few more trips before the summer's out.
Hey, if it works, you keep on doing it.
Well, that's right. And, you know, there is not much activity going on at the Capitol. There is a political circus going on that is called the New York City elections, 2013. So I think that this is a good way for Cuomo to visually keep himself distant and also to strengthen his aim of developing the state and pushing promotion for upstate.
We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who joined us, obviously. Jimmy, thank you very much for being with us. And we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Alan, thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
We'll be back tomorrow with the panel. Coming up next on the program, we will talk to Marlo Thomas. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.